your precious name, amen. All right. Anybody know who that gentleman is up there on the screen?
Yes.
That's a young Napoleon. That's before he started losing his hair. That's right. It's a young Napoleon. The title there, In the Footsteps of the Great Controversy, 1260 Days, Story of Two Empty Tombs. I want you to keep that two empty tombs in mind here, and let's jump right in. Now, back, I guess it's already about 5 years ago, my mother saw advertisement coming out of Andrews University that there was a Great Controversy tour taking place, and that one of the professors there at Andrews was going to lead a Great Controversy tour over in Europe to visit these places of Great Controversy, and we thought that sounded awful good. Basically begins with early Christianity, goes up through the Dark Ages and up through Reformation, all the way through French Revolution, and we're going to do this in 15 days, this quick tour through Europe. Now, what is the Great Controversy? And I know a lot of you guys are familiar with this, but the Great Controversy is essentially, what is this great contest between Christ and Satan? Because from the beginning, Satan has inserted various lies about the character of God. So Great Controversy is that contest, and of course, we are the prize in that contest, right? We're the prize. And the contest is between what exactly is God like? Is Satan, in fact, correct in his depiction of God? Because Satan has fed a whole series of lies, starting with Adam and Eve, a series of lies he feds to them, and he's continued to do that. Now, Satan, we know, I don't want to give him airtime this morning, but we know he's brilliant. And so he has very effectively, throughout human history, asserted one lie after another. And by the way, he changes. When one lie is not working anymore, he shifts on the other foot and starts working another one. And so it's essentially a battle between Christ, God the Father, and Satan on what is God really like. And that is, of course, the Great Controversy. For example, is God loving and just? What is the nature of God? What is it, for example, even a very simple one is, what does it mean to be forgiven and saved? A couple examples of this, a warning, but this is from the New Testament. You see that from this is from Titus, chapter 4, verse 16. Watch your life and doctrine closely. And for 2 Timothy 4, 3, for a time will come when men will not put up with sound doctrine. Instead, to suit their own desires, they will gather around them a great number of teachers to say what their itching ears want to hear. It's a warning for all of us to be careful and to study carefully what the Bible has to say, which really is the nature of God. The tour is led by Dr. Domstig and his wife. They do a fantastic job. If you guys ever have a chance to go on that tour, I really recommend it. They are they're warriors, both of them, especially him. He's not a young man anymore. I'll show you him. But he can walk off the best of us. They really do a fantastic job. He's a tremendous scholar, as is his wife. Both of them are tremendous scholars, so when you ask them a question, they're just a treasury of information on what's taking place. They go on this tour. I don't know if they did it this summer, but they typically do two tours back to back. We retired 15 days, very blessed, tired. They do two of them back to back. So it's extraordinary ministry they put on. There's the two of them together. That's all right. My brother got blurred out. That's fine. But that's the Colosseum there. That's my mother who financed that trip, and that's my brother and I, and we are very happy campers there. One more thing I mentioned about being in, here in America, we don't have a good sense of history oftentimes because most things around us are at most 100 years old, sometimes a little bit older than that, but those bricks you guys see there, those are probably at least close to 2,000 years old. And by the way, the Colosseum is built in part, we believe, after the marble and things were destroyed from the Jewish temple in Jerusalem. Because the Colosseum was not built prior to that time period. We believe even a lot of the labor for the Colosseum, which is still there today, a lot of the labor were Jews who were enslaved from after the Jewish revolt brought to Rome and forced to construct the Colosseum. You see us loading on the bus there. Now, one of the things I mentioned just before we get into the 2600 days, it's kind of interesting. I'm on the bus, and these are all Adventists. Most of them are pastors, and all these good people, all very friendly and so forth. And anyways, we load on the bus, and Dr. Domstig says, on the first day, he said, I want you to mark your seat so you know when you get back on the bus what is your seat. And he said, here's what we're going to do. Every day of the tour, you'll know where your initial seat is. On the next morning, when you go to get on the bus, remember where your seat was, I want you to move forward two rows. And I was like, what? Why? What's that? Anybody know why that would be? Why he's asking everybody to move forward. And then we do it every day. Well, let's be honest here. We think we're all saints and so forth. But what potential problem could arise with all these good people on the bus day after day on this tour? You know how we are in church, right? People choose the good seats, right? It's going to happen, right? They're going to choose the good seats, and there's going to be resentment on the bus tour as you're viewing, the history of God working earth. You got people getting mad at each other and fighting with each other over seats in the bus, right? We wish that wasn't true, but we know each other, right? That's the real deal. And so he's like, well, we're going to fast forward through all that. So every day you move forward two seats the whole trip, and you rotate around the bus, it worked great, no problem. So that's experience, by the way. They did not do that when they first started doing the tours. You say, well, they learned that, so. All right. Now, I'm not going to really go into the things I talked about here a couple years ago, the early church, but just safe to say, when man constructs things, you know, oftentimes we think that is the entire reality, but God knows what's taking place. He's in charge of all these things. This right here looks just like almost like a bunch of rubble. That was downtown Rome. That was Manhattan in Rome today. Downtown Rome, which was the heart of the Roman Empire, this great empire, is today in very bad shape, as you can see. The city has been sacked and ravaged many times. And that was what our Manhattan would look like right there. Now, occasionally we'll come across Roman buildings that are in very good shape. But typically, that's the kind of condition they're in. In fact, right behind us, that's Dr. Domstig leading us on this tour. That is the temple of, you see, divine Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar was assassinated. They took a temple to him. They deified him. That is his temple, which you can see there's not much left today. His temple would be right in that area. Where's my little light here? Is that? There we go. Okay, that's where the temple would be right there. You see he's holding up that little tour book. See where the temple would be. All right. Now let's jump in with it. 1,260 days. Now, by the way, prior to this trip, if you would have asked me to talk about this, I could not have, frankly. I've heard it in Revelation seminars and Daniel and all the rest of that. But that would be within. I've heard of it. I'm familiar with it. But let me help you guys a little bit. This is from Daniel chapter 7, verse 7. Lower a little bit here. I looked, and there before me was a fourth beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had a large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. We believe that, of course, is a depiction of pagan Rome. This is the fourth beast. You guys are familiar with that. This would be the birth expansion of the Roman Empire, of course. And although I've talked about that before, just briefly as a reminder, if you'd visit Rome today, you can see some of the remnants of this. This right here is a Circus Maximus. It's the great stadium in downtown Rome. This is a Palatine Hill right here in the background. This is often where the emperor lived. You can see the Colosseum there in the background. This chariot arena was the biggest arena in the world until late into the 20th century. That held 120,000 people. Is also a site of a large number of executions and massacres of Christians, because a lot of the massacres of Christians took place in the Circus Maximus. Here's a depiction of that. You see those crosses, those are Christians who are being burned, they're covered in oil and being burned, and others being torn apart by wild animals. This is taking place in the Circus Maximus. That's Circus Maximus today. It's still there. The stands are all entirely gone. But the race course where the horses would run, that all is still there. So the footprint is still there. In fact, you could even see it. This is the track going up one side, and then there is going down the other right there. It's massive in a sense of how big it is. And this is some of the remains of the palaces there on the Palpatine Hill right there, where the emperors would have had many of their palaces on the hill right there. Now, as you guys know, there's a series of persecutions under the emperors, but we've talked about that already, so we'll kind of pass that. But persecution of Christians ends under Emperor Constantine, who issued the Edict of Milan in 313 that legalized Christianity. As you guys know, it's a huge flip in the history of the Roman Empire. They go almost overnight from a persecuted and intensely persecuted minority to almost within a very short time to a place of elevation and great power. Constantine, of course, being the Roman Empire, and he has his conversion experience, however genuine that was, in any case, his conversion experience. And suddenly Christianity now moves from being this isolated, persecuted religion and suddenly is in a position of great power. And this is going to change the church profoundly. In many ways, paganism begins to come in the church in a great deal in this time period. As they try to accommodate many of the pagan Romans to make it easier for them to come into the church begins to gradually, and I say tragically, begin to lose a lot of the core doctrines. A good example of this is the coin of Constantine. Right behind him is Sol Invictus. This is a sun god. He's a big fan of his. Even as a Christian emperor, he continued to use this coin and in many ways borrows the imagery of the Sol Invictus, or unconquerable sun, to make that part and bring that kind of concept into Christianity as well. Now, the adoption of Christianity as a state religion begins to profoundly change, of course, the church. All kinds of doctrines of one kind or another are altered and changed. I'm not really, for time, going to go over those things. We've talked about that before. But maybe just a couple of samples of those. For example, the Sabbath, of course, has changed. A whole series of things begin to be changed. That shouldn't happen overnight, but gradually this takes place in the later church. And let's pick it up now with Daniel 7, verse 8. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another one, a little one, which came up among them. And the three horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth that spoke boastfully. Now, a lot of Protestant scholars, Adventist scholars, have concluded that this horn, which came from the beast, is going to be the papacy. And this is the big shift is now Satan, in understanding, has now decided to shift gears. The reason persecution is not working. He's going to come inside the church, essentially. And they see the three horns uprooted before it. Keep that in mind, the three horns, and we'll talk about what those are here in a moment. Now, the early papacy is in Rome. We're talking 200, 300 BC. The early papacy, this is the Pope in Rome, or the Bishop of Rome. They didn't call him the Pope initially, the Bishop. The Bishop of Rome is simply one of the major Christian centers. Of course, you saw Jerusalem, right? Jerusalem, Antioch, Alexandria, Ephesus, other great centers. All of them competing for who's the primary source influence in the church. And for the first several hundred years of apostolic church, Rome was not the center. But when Christianity becomes official Roman religion, that begins to shift more strongly. But even then, it's not over. Now, Revelation 13 and Daniel 7 mention this little horn or beast, and it must overcome an early challenge to its power. Now, if you would have entered the Christian world, say 350, Christianity is now the official religion of the Roman Empire. But the papacy in Rome is still not the preeminent spiritual voice. They are a very influential one because that's the head of the Roman world, of course. But they're still competing with other centers. And so this prophecy right here saying the little horn beast has to deal with these other horns. And those other horns are other very strong controversies taking place in the early church. If you guys are familiar with the New Testament, there's a whole series of things Paul has to deal with, right? Gnosticism, and won't really go into all that stuff, but a whole other series of heresies to come out. One of the really big ones is, what is the nature of Christ? Is Christ, in fact, fully God and fully man? And the Christian church really splits over that. One of the big ones is the Arian faith. The Arian belief, they're Christians, but the Arians essentially believe that Jesus was created, a created being. He's inferior to the Father. Now, we as students of the Bible disagree with that interpretation, but there's a lot of Christians in this time period who follow that line of thinking that are referred to as Arians. In this time period, the Arians had a great deal of influence. There's a big question mark on which way the early Christian churches would go. Are they moved toward a more Arian view of the nature of Christ, or more that we would agree with, which is Trinitarian? So because of that, even though the bishop in Rome held to a belief that we all hold true today, which is the equality of all of the Godhead, so we agree with the Bishop of Rome at that time period, but a lot of the Christian leaders disagreed with that. This is from Daniel 7, verse 25. You shall speak pompous words against the Most High, so persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and laws. Then the saints shall be given into his hands for a time and times and half a time. Now, we're getting to the 1260-day prophecy here. Now, that's kind of a tough one, that time and half a times. I'm not going to have time to go into, so you have to, I won't say trust me, you don't need to trust me. You can look into this a little bit. But biblical scholars believe this corresponds to 3.5 years or 42 months when the saints are going to be persecuted. And Revelation 13:5 says he was given a mouth to speak great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue 42 months. This is a parallel time frame. And 42 months times 30 days equals 1,260 days. A day for the year principle, that's 1,260 years. Now, I know I'm moving kind of quickly through that. For some of you, if you're not familiar with this, you're kind of like, this is getting murky here. But be patient. We'll take a look here. Okay. Now, just a little bit of background, then we'll get jumping into what's taking place here. The Roman Empire late splits into two parts. You have a Western Roman Empire and the Eastern. That'll be important for me to explain what's coming up here in a moment. Oh, let me go back one more. Do you guys see this place right here, Byzantium? Constantine made that his new capital. Rome by this time period is not the city it used to be. It's kind of fallen to harder times. So Constantine, as Roman Empire, thinks the East is richer, and he makes a brand new capital right there, Byzantium. We also call it Constantinople, too. But he makes his great capital right there, and the Roman world is really split. While this is taking place, the Western Roman Empire has a whole series of barbarians that invade them. And the barbarians are going to end the Western Roman Empire. You can see a whole group of those. You see the Vandals there, the Visigoths, we'll talk about it a little bit, and other groups who destroyed the Western Roman Empire. In 1476, Rome is sacked. The last of the Roman emperors, who is Italian, is replaced by a barbarian emperor. We consider this official way to end the Roman Empire. And by the way, just as student history, we kind of think Rome ended there. But that's only partially correct. Because remember, there's a whole eastern part of the Roman Empire, right? That did not end. That continues, and we'll explain why that matters here. Okay. Now, Rome, the city of Rome itself, has been sacked twice in the last 50 years. The city of Rome is not in good shape. The bishop of Rome, or the pope, is still there, but Rome has fallen on very hard times. Additionally, to make things worse for the papacy, you have these barbarians who have invaded Rome, and now they're in charge. No longer are the Romans in charge. These are the Germanic barbarians. The Germanic barbarians who are in control in Rome are Arians by faith. They have converted to Christianity, but they're Arians. In this case, the papacy is very weak because they don't hold the military power. They do not control Italy or the Western Roman Empire. These barbarians do, and these barbarians are Arians in belief. This gives you an idea of some of the tribes there. Now, the Eastern Roman Empire continues. You can see that over on the right. Still headed at its capital, Constantinople. But the Western Roman Empire ceased to exist. Now it's controlled by a whole variety of barbarian tribes. The Ostrogoths occupy Italy. Now, here, be patient. Don't glaze over on me now. So I know as a professor of history, I have to engage you guys. Now, this is all going to start making sense. So just be a little patient why all this makes sense here. The Ostrogoths, they have converted to Christianity, but they're Arians. They do not support the papacy in Rome. The Ostrogoth kingdom there, you can see it's ruling primarily Italy and a little bit into southern France and into the Balkans. Emperor Theodoric, he's this Ostrogoth king, a great king for them, rules in Rome. He is to have the capital moved to his new capital, which is Ravenna on the coast. That's one of his coins there. He's a Christian, but he's an Arian. Now, let's pick up with the tour. I have to have a little background here. This will make sense here. Okay, so on the tour, we left Rome, and we journeyed up to Ravenna. Do you guys see Ravenna right there? Right on the coast. Now, this had become the capital of the Western Roman Empire right at the very end because Rome was in bad shape. And these barbarian tribes also made it their capital, in this case, Theodoric. We arrived on the bus tour. We got about 10 minutes at the beach. That's what you can do for 10 minutes. You can walk in the water for a few minutes. It's beautiful. It's right on the coast of Italy. It's a very nice city, not particularly large, but it's in good shape. It's a nice, beautiful city. It's my mom there who paid for it. Hopefully her legs won't blind you. But I don't think she's here. Okay, so. So, okay, now, it's interesting because when you're looking around Ravenna, Dr. Domstick took us to this building right here. It's a relatively small building. This is the mausoleum of the Ostrogoth King Theodoric. This is his tomb. So we go walk inside. And that's the inner chamber for his tomb, and that thing looks like a big I guess, pinkish bathtub. That was his very expensive, opulent sarcophagus. That's all marble. It's a very unusual marble. That marble is incredibly expensive, very difficult. But he was the master of all Italy, so he could have that supplied for his burial chamber. There's another picture of that. Now, you guys can't see it from this angle, but that thing is completely empty. What happened to good old Theodoric? Because he's not there. It looks almost like a bathtub. It's completely empty. Now keep in mind, why is that tomb empty? And one other thing I mentioned about Ravenna. Ravenna is a really beautiful little city. When we first got there, Dr. Domestig warned us, said, look, he'd actually warned us in Rome. What he had told us in Rome is, a lot of you Americans are used to crossing the road in American fashion. You can't do that in Italy, because they will kill you. Not intentionally, of course, but the Italians drive very fast. It's kind of Mario Andretti for the whole country. Right? So in Italy, what that means is, in Italy, here's how you cross the street. As an American, do not cross on your own. Stand with Italians, cross when they do. Now, my brother and I, we're still in pretty decent shape. We're like, oh, come on, it's not that bad. Ask my brother if you ever meet him sometime. He crossed a little bit late by himself. That was almost the last thing he did. Because the way they drive fast. Now, in Ravenna, the reason I'm showing you these bikes is in Ravenna, we get off the bus, and Pastor Domestig said, look, now, Ravenna is special. It's a beautiful city. There's a lot of important things we see here in the Great Controversy. But I want you guys to be careful. People in Ravenna ride their bikes very seriously. And not like you do here in Merced, like people go out in the morning from exercise stuff. No, people going to the market ride their bikes. They ride their bikes, go and have tea, eat dinner, whatever, go to meet friends. They ride their bikes. They ride them in the city streets. The city streets are quite small and narrow, and they're riding in large numbers all the time, and they ride fast. So he said, what that means is, if you have a few minutes to walk around the city's streets of Ravenna, walk in a straight line. Don't suddenly see something in some window, like, I got to look at that. Because when you got to look at that, what's going to happen to you? A bike rider is going to hit you from behind. And by the way, he was right about that. Here's the streets there, Ravenna. You can see a bunch of bikes all along there. I like his photograph. This is a mother taking her son probably to market, and they're zooming along at fairly high speed. You see all those couples also riding at high speed. And I was telling my wife, the reason why I put this in there is besides just a safety factor, you kind of culturally, you guys know this when you move from culture to culture, you have to be aware of different cultural things. For you to survive and thrive, you know what's going on in that culture. Well, in a spiritual sense, we have that going on here on earth, right? Because we live in American culture here, and there's a lot of positive things, but there's also some corrosive negative things as well, too. We have to be careful we don't get so comfortable in the culture, we miss what's really taking place. All right. Now, in Ravenna, there's a couple churches there that are full of very impressive murals, and these are very important for what we're talking about back to the 2600 days. I was a little bit surprised that the Italians graffiti like we do here, but their appreciation of history is about the same as ours sometimes. You go to some of the churches that are very beautiful mosaics. Ravenna is world famous for the beautiful mosaics. By the way, all that area in the back, that's gold. These are three wise men. This is a little bit blurred out, but you have omnipresence being in Italy of the persecution by papal Rome. All these figures right here, there's Latin names above them. All these who are martyrs, you see holding the laurel wreaths there. That's the crown of the martyr. All these who are martyrs of the early church. Same thing for the women, too. All these women are also martyred for their faith. See there, you can see the Latin names above their heads there. This is a depiction of Jesus being baptized. It's interesting because he kind of Romanized there, right? Where's his beard? Because we're pretty sure he had a beard. We know he did. But, you know, this is the Roman version, so, and they depict him as a beardless young man. We went into one of the annexes of the church, and they had this mosaic there. And this is one of the early church fathers who was martyred by the pagan Roman Empire. They burned him on that rack. And his name was Saint Lorenzo. And I thought, wow, that is too close to home. Lorenzo, that's... Now, in the church, we came across this mural here. This gentleman's name is Justinian. He's one of the greatest of all the Eastern Roman emperors, what we call Byzantium or Byzantine emperors. Now, he's very important, and we'll go back to that tomb here in a minute. During his reign, his goal was to completely rebuild the Roman Empire. The Western Roman Empire, as you guys know, have been conquered by the barbarians. But he's like, we're going to fix that. He's Roman in thought. We're going to reclaim the entire Roman Empire, and we're going to make the strongest as it used to be, maybe even better. Now, he's a Christian, by the way. And he goes, also, to strengthen it, we're going to make sure that everybody is right in the faith. And so we're going to stop any kind of dissension within the church, the Arians, or whoever. We're going to make sure that comes to an end. So that is his goal, is to completely rebuild the Western Roman Empire, kick out these barbarians, and protect the Christian church in his eyes. He sends one of his best generals, called Belarusus, to North Africa, takes care of the Vandals there, reconquers most of North Africa, then sends that general to Italy. And that general, after a lot of hard campaigning, you don't need to follow the dots there, but is eventually able to defeat the Ostrogoths under Theodoric already died, but the Ostrogoths, and reclaims Rome. Now, we're getting to why this is significant. Now, remember, the papacy, in a sense, has been weakened, right? Because the barbarian tribes have taken over Italy. The papacy has been weakened. They're competing with other Christian centers. Even worse, the local overlords of Rome are Arians who do not agree with the papacy and what belief in the church and theology. So the papacy, its voice is quite weak in this era. Now, Justinian, prior to this conquest, as part of his campaign to unify this new Roman world, has the Code of Justinian put in place, which has very stringent, and by stringent, it's a nice way, it has a great deal of laws put in place that lead to direct persecution for belief. Now, this has been going on for a while. There's been a lot of combat within the Christian church already. But when Justinian does this, this formalizes an empire-wide unified belief. That's his wife, Theodora, there, and her attendants. A depiction of her. Okay, now, why does all this matter? Here's why this matters. Why was Theodoric's tomb there empty? Remember, he's an Arian, right? He's a Christian, but he's an Arian Christian. When the Byzantium armies under Justinian invaded Italy, they, in their eyes, they freed Rome of the Arian contagion, the way they would look at it. They go to Theodoric's tomb. Now remember, he's an Arian, right? He's a Christian, but he's an Arian. And the idea of the intensity of the religious conflict, they go to his tomb, take poor old Theodoric, and they throw his bones on an ash heap. Disappears from history. But he's been long dead. He's been dead for a while. But they're not satisfied with that. They view him as a heretic, and they cleanse his tomb of his existence, almost to wipe him off the map. This is one of the few mosaics we have from his time. This is one of Theodoric's mosaics. By the way, he used to be in there. Do you guys see him there now? This is called the ancient version of Photoshop, right? It's called Find Waldo. Where'd Theodoric go? Because he was in this. This is one of his mosaics. Now, if you guys look really close, you guys see, now, when they Photoshopped this, they did make a little mistake. You can see just a little bit of a shadow of what it used to contain, this mosaic. Do you guys see a hand in there anywhere? If you look really closely. Here, I'll help you guys by zooming in a little bit. Oh, there's Waldo. Theodoric used to be there, but not anymore. Because Justinian's armies now control Italy, and they could put the Arian controversy to rest. By the rest, we mean persecution and entire elimination. Now, by the way, as Seventh-day Adventists, we believe the Arians are wrong about the nature of Christ. So on the one hand, we're like, well, that was a heresy, so we're glad that was eliminated. But the point was, this is not eliminated through conversation or conversion or explanation. It's eliminated by force, brute force. And not just the Arian controversy. Any kind of differing view of the theology than what Justinian and the Pope of Rome had now is to be met by overwhelming force and persecution. Another example of that, this is books being burned. These are Arian books being burned by the church. Now, that is official policy and official law now throughout this rebuilt Roman Empire. And this will continue throughout all the medieval time period as well. This is the beginning of what we call the 1260 days of persecution. Now, the Pope in Rome, because of Justinian elevating the Pope, and with military force supporting him, the papacy now is in a position of preeminence. All of the Christian centers, Ephesus, Alexandria, all the rest of those which used to vie for control of the Christian faith, now those have all been replaced and sidelined. This example of persecution is in 1572. This is a great persecution took place in France by the Catholics attacking the Protestants. If you were here a couple years ago, I talked about the Waldensians and what happened to Waldensians. This is the top of Casaluso here, where we believe hundreds of Waldensians were hurled to their death, escaping papal forces who had come to kill them. In a very savage kind of way, I think I mentioned before, what happened is the papal force actually came and stayed with them in their houses, and the Waldensians invited them in. Then a signal, they rose up early in the morning and began to kill the Waldensians. Now, of course, God is not going to allow his faithful to entirely endure this persecution. And even during these dark time periods, there is beginning to be a change. This is from Ravenna. Ravenna was the home of Dante, the great Italian poet. Dante wrote a series of books. His most famous is going to be The Divine Comedy. Divine Comedy, if you're familiar with the classical literature, Dante, in his version of hell, because his book is divided into three parts, is hell, and then purgatory, and heaven. In hell, Dante, very upset and troubled by what he sees going on within the Catholic Church, places a series of the popes themselves and bishops inside hell in his book. By the way, it's very dangerous in that time period to do that, for Dante to do that. The Inquisition was looking for him, not surprisingly. So it's amazing that he died a peaceful death, because placing a pope in hell in your fictional account is not the best way to live out a long and happy life. But in a sense, but that's happened in the 1300s. But that is stirring some of the later Protestant embers that will lead to what we know as the Reformation. That's his tomb there. All right. Now, let's get to the end. Now, the date we left off when Justinian's armies freed Rome was 538. I don't think I stressed that. It was 538 when they freed Rome, and the papacy is able to gain power and strength. Now, it's 538. Now, if you do the math, 1260, you guys have a calculator with you, or if you pull your phone out, 538 plus 1260 years, what would that total to? 1798, maybe some biblical scholars out there, 1798. Now, by the way, for this prophecy to work, something better, a big happened in 1798, right? It better work. Now, this is Napoleon. Napoleon in 1798 is campaigning in Italy, northern Italy. This is the French Revolution that had taken place just prior to this. The French Revolution is very anti-Christian. We'll talk about that next week. Very anti-Christian. We'll talk about why that is, but that won't be for today, this morning. Very anti-Christian. Napoleon is campaigning in northern Italy. They're thinking about disposing, going down to central Italy into Rome itself and kicking the Pope out of power. They have not done but thinking about that. They're negotiating with the Pope. There's Pope Pius VI, and sadly, he's in the blur, but it's Pope Pius VI. Now, here's how it takes place. The French Revolutionary Government is in negotiations with the Pope to allow him maybe hold on to some of his power, but in a very weakened state. Now, one of Napoleon's generals, General Dufault right there, who is a pledge, he's a fiancé of Napoleon's brother's sister-in-law. I'm not sure how that works exactly, but say a soon-to-be family member, essentially. He sends Dufault down to Rome to negotiate with the Pope. There's a confrontation between the papal soldiers from the Vatican and General Dufault. General Dufault goes out to calm things down. His attempt to calm things down, he is shot, which you see depicted right here. He's shot and killed. Now, what this means essentially is the Pope's soldiers killed Napoleon's soon-to-be close relative. How do you think Napoleon's going to take that? Already, the French Revolution government is very anti-Christian already. So when this happens, do you think Napoleon is going to let that lie? You know he's not going to let that die. This guy was going to be his family member. So Napoleon and the French government send down General Berthier to arrest the Pope. And that is, if you're doing the math, not surprisingly, in February 1798, the Pope is arrested. And he, from that point, loses his papal power. Now, by the way, the papacy had been losing strength over the past several hundred years because of the Reformation and other issues going on. But this is the formal end of papal power. See, 538. in 798. This is 1260 years exactly. Here's a couple of depictions. In that case, that's General Bertha arriving, hand his note to the Pope, and the Pope in this case being arrested, placed in a carriage, and they're in the process of bringing him to Paris so they have control of him. This ends, in a sense, that papal period of persecution. If you go to Rome today, that's the palace where this took place. The Palace of Orsini, that's where General Dufont was killed by the papal soldiers. This is a big turning point in biblical history. So when you walk through those halls, it's a nice building, realize what took place in the courtyard is a summation of prophecy. The Pope was taken north toward France. They stopped several times along the way. This is our Chiesa of Florence, just outside Florence. There's a nice monastery there. They briefly allowed the Pope to kind of take a break there. We arrived there for a brief tour. Now, by the way, it's kind of interesting because it's still run by the Catholic Church. There are three very devout monks that were living there. So it's kind of interesting. When you're on a great controversy tour, how do you arrive there at the monastery and say, we want to see the papal apartments where the Pope was imprisoned? It's part of our great controversy tour. So Dr. Domsing is very polite, and he didn't really go into that part. We just asked them if we could tour there. By the way, just one more thing. When we got there, the bus pulls up, we all pile out, and Dr. Domsted walks up to the front gate, and a gardener meets us. The gardener just wanted to lay members of the community, and the gardener was surly and unfriendly. In fact, we didn't think we'd even get inside, because the gardener's like, no, you guys aren't coming in. It's a monastery. No. It's kind of a good warning for church, right, what we're like when people first arrive. I thought, it's a monastery. It's supposed to be kind of God's place. But the gardener is a very unfriendly individual. But fortunately, one of the monks walked by, that gentleman right there. He's a very nice man. And he invited us inside, and he gives us a tour. And he very generously gave us a tour of the place. The whole time when he was doing the tour, by the way, we heard him kind of quietly talking to himself. And I was wondering, what's he doing? Then I realized he was praying. So as he was leading the tour, even though quietly between him explaining things, he was praying. He's a very nice gentleman. He gave us a very nice tour. One more interesting thing is that as we were leaving, Dr. Domstig talked to that monk a little bit and said, hey, to prevent miscommunication in the future, is there a way I can get a hold of you? Is there a phone number? I'll call you next time we come. That way we can set it up. We don't have to worry about gardeners and stuff, and we can just come on in. And he said, and so Dr. Domstig said, do you have email? Could I email you and then let you know when we're going to arrive, and then we can set it all up and make it easy? And it's funny because the monk says, don't email me. I do have an email account, but the monk that controls the computer doesn't like me. So he probably won't give me the email. Now, by the way, there's only three monks there. And the monk on the computer, so I just thought, that's what we have to deal with as human beings, right? God's dealing with this. It's very supposed to be a holy place, but the monks aren't talking to each other. So this monk said, but I do have a cell phone. Which he didn't want to cover the cell phone. He said, just call me and I'll let you guys in. You can tour the papal apartments there. That's where the Pope was briefly stationed. That's commemorating the Pope. And he was there for 3 or 4 months before he journeyed on his way to France. There's another picture up there from the monastery. Now, are you guys getting hungry? We're going to wrap it up. Why does this matter? In 2013, why do we care about a prophecy that's already been fulfilled, and that was several hundred years ago? Why does it matter? Because it's already happened, right? It's good news. I'm glad we don't live in that time of persecution. That's gone. It's done. So why does that matter to us? Why is it important? By the way, God has it in the Bible, so we presume, right? It's got to be important. So why is that? You can throw out some answers, by the way. This is the participation time. There is more prophecies. That's a big one. There's more to come, right? The story's not over yet, right? The papacy and perhaps other powers will be rebuilt. That's for another day. But the Bible has many prophecies that are ongoing into the future. So God is saying, I'm trying to help you. And you guys know, for example, in Matthew, when Christ is warning the Christians to flee Jerusalem, he's talking, we believe, about the end times well, but also very contemporary. Christ was warning them, saying, you don't know what's coming. Because when the Romans besieged Jerusalem in 72 AD, that siege that Christ is warning them to flee was an awful, awful siege. So Christ was very practically saying, I'm trying to spare you. You don't know what it's going to be like. I'm trying to spare you. So, of course, we have ongoing prophecy. But besides that, okay, let's set that one aside. Besides ongoing prophecy, we need to know about, what does this prophecy do for us? I like that one, too. Confidence in God's word, the Bible. By the way, for those of you who got kind of lost in some of those Ostrogoths and Theodoric and all the rest of that, aren't you glad that God knows all that stuff? Amen. Intimately, right? Because by the way, unless you're like a history major like me, that's what you do for a living, we kind of let that stuff flow away because by the way, I think it doesn't really touch me. But aren't you glad that Almighty God knows the absolute details of all that's going to happen ahead of time? Exactly. But not just on the global level, but on the personal level too. He knows exactly what's going to happen. We play great confidence because you guys know, you listen to the media, pick up a newspaper, go online. People look at the Bible. The Bible is a nice book, has nice moral instructions, has some nice things in it, but don't take it too literally. You know, the virgin birth, all that stuff. You know, we scientifically know that stuff could not really be the way it is. And finally, I'd say the last one, trust in a God who knows all about us. Like when I was thinking about this too, I was almost debating whether to even do the 1260 days. I thought, you know, it's kind of a tough one. It's a little bit tough, you know, to read the symbolism. And in a way, it doesn't seem like it's really touching us directly. But the more I studied and getting ready for this, I thought, you know, it is very comforting to know that God knows very intimately what's taking place all across the world and throughout time and all in our own personal lives. You know, as I'm wrapping it up, I was thinking, you know, I say for me in the past, sometimes when I read prophecy, I know if it, in my own life, if I was going through some difficult time, some painful struggles, I'd be like, prophecy's good, and I know it's really important, but right now I'm hurting, and that doesn't seem to really help with what I'm dealing with. You know, it could be illness in the family or personal thing. Just, you know, it doesn't really seem in a sense to really help that, to really touch that core. But as I was studying this past week and thinking about this, I thought, but, you know, in a way it does, because it's reminded how intimately God cares about all aspects of our life. In this case, even our daily struggles. I put this shady character in here at the end here, because on this tour as a story and also as a student of the Bible, I was so excited to be there. This is the road right here that Paul took into Rome. Now, it's great to read about in the Bible. It's fantastic, but you know what's even better? To be there, right? That's why you have that goofy grin on my face right there. I was kind of blurred, but and wearing that very touristy shirt right there, it's probably not the best choice, but you guys see all these grooves right here? This road is 2,000 years old. Where are those grooves from? Wagons and chariots by the tens of thousands have left their mark literally in the stones there. And when I was standing there, and Dr. Domstig was telling us, I was like, these are the stones that Paul tread on his way into Rome. That's his route into Rome. That would take you right into downtown Rome. And I was like, this is cool to actually sink your toes, well, not literally, but put your toes there directly where Paul stood. It's a whole different feeling to actually be there in the place, to really touch it and make it personal. Because it's nice to read in a book, and that's important, but to really feel it. And so when I was concluding this, I thought, isn't that what ultimately we want to do with the Bible too, is to make it personal? And as I was thinking, as I was closing, I thought, what is the reassurance we get from the Bible? The Bible is full of fantastic promises of God's individual care for all of us. These are two that I really like. Now, I encourage you guys, I know many of you already have your own, but these are two I really like that are really reassuring. This one right here says, from 1 Peter 5, verse 10. And the God of all grace, who called you to his eternal glory in Christ, after you have suffered a little while, will himself restore you, make you strong, firm, and steadfast. Now, here's where I like this one. When I read this, I was going through this stuff right here. I was going through some really tough stuff at the time. And I was like, God, this is really painful. When's it going to end? You know, you guys know what we're talking about. We live here in the world for a while. When to get in? I need some help with this. And what really touched me is this part right here saying, himself will restore you. I thought in a very personal way, Christ, God the Father, in a very personal way would come to me and help give me peace on that issue. Maybe not exactly the way I imagine it, but peace. And in a personal way, not like he'll send an angel, or he'll delegate that, or he'll just change your mind, that he will personally intervene. And this one's right too, Isaiah 49:15. Can a woman forget her nursing child that she should not have compassion on the son of her womb? I see my wife and her care for our kids, the most important thing in the world to her. It's beautiful. Just watch what a mother does with kids. Just, there's nothing like it. And my mom too, you know. She's the one who paid for that tour. We couldn't afford that. I see what a mom does for kids. But here it says, can a mother have not compassion on her kids, son of her womb? Yes, they may forget, yet I will not forget you. That's God saying, even in the strange situation, perhaps your own mother, perhaps she, as impossible as it might seem, may forget, I will not forget you. And what a wonderful promise from our Father. Finally, conclusion of the title, I said two tombs, right? You guys remember that? We've only seen one, right? I was looking at that, I was like, poor old Theodoric, he got thrown out of his very opulent tomb there, and that he kind of disappeared from history outside of a thing like this. But we also celebrate an empty tomb, right? Yeah, we have a father who he's not found any tomb anywhere. We know right now he reigns. He's directly involved in our lives. And today I want to show all of you, too, that maybe in a sense the 1260-day prophecy may seem kind of like it's biblical trivia, but that's God's reassurance that all aspects of our lives, in the past and the future, he's directly, intimately involved with us. He loves us, and he's caring for all of you today. May you have that reassurance in your hearts. Why don't we bow for prayer? Gracious Father in heaven, we're so grateful that you have loved us and you give us the Bible. And the Bible is full of an extraordinary treasury of many aspects of your love. Some are the Psalms and the Gospels, and some are prophecy. Help us to be reassured, Father, that whatever we're going through today, that you know intimately, personally what's taking place, that you love us, care for us, and that despite appearances, that you are carrying us step by step. May we go forward with the reassurance of this today. May all those be blessed who are here this morning. I pray this, Father, in your wonderful name. Amen.